The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and by popular demand, I'm delighted again to be able to speak to Paul Scott of Stockopedia, one of the UK's finest small and micro-cap investors. So welcome, Paul.
Hi, Paul, and thanks for having me back.
Yeah, well, actually, when we spoke 3 months ago, you were pretty bullish on the markets after a good sort of year-to-date performance. But then we had sort of like the March mini banking madness and higher interest rates. So putting all that together, what's your sort of outlook just in top level going into the, for the rest of the year?
Well, I don't really have a strong view either way about markets as a whole, because it just sets you up for looking like an idiot, doesn't it, if you try and predict these things. So, I mean, I just look at it purely at the, what I see at the moment is small caps, really, really attractive valuations in many cases. And that's really as far as I go. I think the macro side looks after itself in the long run. And, you know, inflation looks like it's set to come down to about 5% by the end of this year, according to the Bank of England, a little bit higher than previously. You know, interest rates probably peaked. Maybe we haven't seen the damage yet from that. So there's lots of moving parts, aren't there? But, you know, most of the small caps I'm looking at, you're now getting an opportunity to buy really nice quality companies on PE ratios of 9 or 10 in a year when earnings are, in many cases, are actually suppressed. So I can see a lot, I mean, literally, I would say several hundred small caps, UK small caps, where I could imagine that share being at least double the current price once the economy is a bit more settled. So to me, that's just really attractive, just to buy and hold. I'm not trading, I'm just buying and holding.
Yeah, well, as I say, you sound pretty optimistic there, certainly on a sort of like a medium to long term basis. How's the portfolio been sort of faring? And have you modified your sort of investment strategy at all over the last few months? Was it really sort of like, you know, dig through the details, the balance sheets? What have you been doing?
Well, I think we've discussed this before. You know, I'm not setting myself up to be some sort of investing guru. I just enjoy the analysis, and I think I'm probably a better analyst than I am investor. So just wanted to set the ground by saying that. But what was the question again, Paul?
It was just really sort of like, how's your portfolio doing? And have you modified your investment strategy at all, given the sort of like the higher interest rates and the decreasing inflation?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, definitely. I mean, I'm not using any leverage now. I've completely eliminated leverage because it just caused these ridiculous roller coaster rides of making millions, losing millions, and the cycle going on over and over again. I mean, it could be 5 or 6 years of doing well, but then there'd always come a point where something would go disastrously wrong and I'd be 3 or 4 times geared. And I just thought, I can't be doing that. So now I'm right back to investing basics, just buying and holding in tax-free wrappers like SIP, ISAs, and so on mainly. And just buying things that I think have got really good medium-term upside. Yeah. So that's my strategy now. And yes, I'm having a really good year, actually. Last year, in the context that last year was absolutely catastrophically bad, because that was when I had the gearing combined with a lot of bad sector picks and bad, you know, the whole thing was just a disaster last year. But you can't dwell on these things. All investors have the occasional bad year. And I think you draw a line under it and start afresh. Don't chase your losses and don't necessarily keep hanging on to the same old stocks. So I used really this January as a chance to do a reset. And I got this 200% premium takeover bid on Seraphine.
Of course, yes.
Trent, we've talked about before, and that one was just good luck. I mean, takeover bids always are, really, to a certain extent. You can look at things that might be good takeover candidates, but when bids come through, I normally get 2 or 3 bids a year. I'm sure you probably do as well. And, you know, there is an element of luck, and I got lucky with Seraphine. And then I sold them immediately in the market, which is an interesting point, actually, that you might want to develop on, because we've had 3 mid-cap bids fall through before they've been.
Oh, we have, really? Yeah, just recently, haven't we?
Yeah. THG was sort of a tentative bid. There was John Wood Group, and there was Emis as well, wasn't there? All 3 fell through, which was really surprising. So I think there's a lot to be said in the current market for just selling in the market as soon as you know, a bid is announced, just to be on the safe side. So that's what I did with Seraphine. And then I recycled, which was by far my biggest position, and I recycled the money into 3 shares, which have all 3 gone up 25% since January. Brilliant. So
Well, we'll come on to those. We'll come on to those in a moment, I guess. Now,
yeah, so far so good, but it's one of those years where it feels terrible. I don't know if you, the gains seem to happen suddenly in vertical moves, but nearly every other day is just a grind downwards. Mm. So it feels incredibly painful this year, but actually, it's for that reason, I think.
Well, yeah, I think you've just done really well, because actually, if you look at AIM as an index, I believe it's down this year. So.
Yeah.
If you've beaten, you know, if you're well up, then you've done well. I would say, just adding to what you've talked about in terms of, you know, stocks being up, the volumes haven't been that high. So
that's true.
The idea, you know, I wouldn't bank all your gains straight away, as like, you know, in your mind anyway, because things can move quite quickly on low liquidity, whether it's up or down. But done.
You're right. And when the market does decisively turn, and I've seen this a few times in my career, I mean, March 2020 was a good example. I think 2009 was another one, and 2003, those spring to mind. That's where, when the market began to turn in small caps, the moves up, as you say, liquidity had almost dried up in all three of those dates I just said. When the liquidity came back, there were no sellers left.
Yeah.
So actually, these things can really go up almost in a straight line and quite fast when that turn does happen. The big question is, obviously, we don't know the timing, do we? I mean, we could have another year or 18 months of a bear market, but I think we're probably nearer the end than the beginning in the small caps bear market. I don't know about the larger caps. Yeah.
Well, that'd be good to hear, that's for sure. Now, I understand one position you've bought, which is a favourite from the past, actually, Sazander, which is a sort of like online ladies retailer for sort of like all ages, but mainly sort of middle-aged ladies, and run by a couple of co-CEOs who are founders. And actually, when I spoke to Paul Jordan last week, and he was really complimentary about them. What's your sort of latest on Sazander and why you've gone back in?
Incidentally, I listened to your podcast with Paul Jordan. It was fantastic. I mentioned it in my own podcast this weekend.
So did you? Okay.
You might have created a sort of endless loop.
He is very good. There's no doubt about
it. Yeah, really independent thinker, thinks differently. I think he was a professional violinist before becoming a fund manager.
Yes, I think he named the company anyway, Amati, after the profession. Yeah, the famous violinist. That's for sure.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's his name. That's the famous. But anyway, regardless of that, he knows his onions, doesn't he, Paul Jordan?
He does. Yeah, very interesting guy. And yes, I was interested in what he said on Sazander. I mean, I followed Sazander since when it reversed into a cash shell, which actually, incidentally, is a good way to do things for microcaps, because you've got a ready-made shareholder register that are transacting. So it just doesn't run into the same liquidity problems. It's not really retailing. It's a fashion brand, very distinctive fashion brand with differentiated product that they design in-house. And it's worked. It's worked brilliantly. It's now profitable. The downside was that it had to raise considerably more equity to get there than planned. But that's pretty much done now. They've got 10 million net cash. Really, really interesting third-party wholesale deals with Next, M&S, John Lewis, Very. And these big, they've got their marketplace websites. They are approaching Sazander, and we say, we want your product on our marketplace. And it's flying off the virtual shelves. and basically the business model with Sazander is now proven. It's working, it's profitable, shouldn't need another raise. And the last raise was purely because they wanted to buy more inventories. So it's not cash flow positive yet, but that's because they're having to build the inventories for these wholesale partners, which is very good business, because the wholesale partners deal with everything. And Sazander just makes a 10, 15% margin, whatever it is, might be more. But the key thing I like at this point about Sazander is it's basically de-risked. It's now working, it's profitable. But they're now going for international growth. And if you remember back to the days when ASOS was a small startup, the share price went crazy when it announced international expansion. That's where you get a really serious multi-bagger effect. And so Sazander's currently valued, I think, at about £60 million.
Yeah, that's right. Cap, yeah, spot on.
Which is not cheap, but it's forecast to do, I think, 57 million revenues in the current year, which is March 2024. And profit of around $3.5 million. So yeah, you can actually justify the valuation on a traditional valuation metric of a PE ratio. But you've then got all that potentially exponential growth. And there was a really good webinar recently with Mellow Monday, David Streder's webinars, and they were saying, they went to a trade show in Dubai, and you know, there was so much interest in the brand. I think they're going to get the same effect internationally, where these big e-commerce sites are going to be clamoring for the gear because it sells. The customers love it. They've got great customer loyalty. There are so many positive things about this. So I think the trick is not to look at it as just another e-commerce business. I think this is different. This is actually a differentiated brand that I think is looking very exciting. I think 5, 6, 7 years or something, you could put a zero on the end of this share price if the international growth takes off. But it's not for faint-hearted, you know, and it's not, well, actually, now it's profitable. I think you could say it might be for the faint-hearted. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've got a good, very good track record in this, because I can remember coming out of the financial crisis, you were one of the first who spotted Boohoo. And I think you sort of went in there at about, I don't know, 10p or 20p.
I think it was 23, 24p. Okay, yeah.
And then went up to about £4, didn't it, or something?
Yeah, no, I always say with Boohoo, I got it massively right in 2015 and massively wrong in 2021, unfortunately.
Yeah. So what's your latest view on Boohoo? Because they came out with their results, I think, or trading update, and it was they're sort of indicating or guiding the first half's going to be tough sledging. They're going to have negative like for likes, but they're going to go positive in the next half, and then over time increase the margins as they expand into, I think it's America and into Europe.
It was February 2023 full year results, and the stuff you're referring to is obviously in the Outlook comments. I'm fairly neutral on Boohoo at the moment, because the original reason I was in it was because it had, you know, graphs doing 45 degree increases in revenues and profits, whatever, 10% EBITDA margin. Well, the picture now is it's only bumping along around break even. So that's a totally different investment case, you know, where the story and the facts and figures change, I obviously change my view on it. So I don't want to, you know, I'm not one of these investors who sort of gets emotionally tied to a share. I think you just look at it fresh every time they report. And for me, the investment case at Boohoo is a lot less interesting, if it's interesting at all now, given that the story now is that, oh, they can rebuild margins, which I think they will be able to, because the worst of the supply chain stuff is now behind them. Factory gate prices are falling for clothing. But they're up against this monster Chinese competitor, Shein, which I think has just been killing the sector, killing its rivals in the sector on the quiet. We've seen lots of fast fashion businesses disappear or get bought out of administration or close to administration by Mike Ashley. You know, Misguided was quite a big one. I saw it first. That was one of the Kamani brothers, actually, who did that as a competitor to Boohoo. So, and I see the guy, again, a family member who ran Pretty Little Thing, has moved on. Well, none of these things are telling you that it's a very exciting area anymore, are they? So
I think you're spot on with the with basically Shein, because my sort of theory on it is actually they've got a sort of competitive advantage in terms of TikTok, because obviously they're both owned by Chinese companies, and that is the way they sell fast fashion internationally on the brand, and because it's that sort of demographic. And I'm sure when you do searches and sort of like, you know, key terms or whatever it is for videos on TikTok, I bet Shein comes up first deliberately, because it's owned by the Chinese. I don't know. It's probably, it could be a sort of like, you know, I don't know, a hunch, but
You could be right. I mean, the only thing I would say is, I mean, Boohoo is doing the right stuff, I think. I certainly wouldn't write it off. And it was 1.7 billion, I think, revenues spread across 14 or 15 brands. You know, this US distribution center that they're bringing in will mean they go from customers having to wait 10 days to get a parcel to getting it next day, which is what you want. You know, with Shein, I think is it 2 week delay to get the parcels?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't write off Boohoo. That's all I'm saying. But a 500-600 million market cap, it doesn't particularly appeal to me.
Yeah.
Based on the new facts, whereas ASOS, I wouldn't go near.
Yeah. So what's your latest view on ASOS then? Is it, because it isn't really a brand, is it? Well, it's got part of its sales, I think, are its own brand, but the vast majority is third party.
It is. And I mean, this has always been ASOS's big problem. The gross margin has always been low. And I think their latest results, if you factor in 100 odd million or more excess stock provision, well, that's just bad buying and, you know, bad management. So that's not something you should adjust out. That's something you should take on the chin if you've got the product wrong. Their gross margin was only about 37-38%, which is hopeless. You cannot make money when the customers send half of the gear back if you're only making a 38% margin. So I'm very, very bearish on ASOS. I think that could go to zero unless they turn it round. They're making extravagant claims about the turnaround that they want to achieve, but I saw no evidence of it in the figures. And the balance sheet is disintegrating rapidly. If you look at net tangible asset value at ASOS, it's almost disappeared. Whereas Boohoo, you've got much, much stronger net tangible asset value and much, much stronger liquidity. So, I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if we see ASOS going from zero to 5 billion market cap back to zero?
Yeah, you know, well, you might have Boohoo going back to your entry price of 23p as well.
Well, yeah, it's not far off.
That'll be a quandary for you.
Yeah, yeah, no, quite. I think it's important, as I say, just not to get attached to these things and be looking for, you know, to a certain extent, I've kind of drawn a line under those. You know, they didn't work. Let's move on and find something with better risk reward.
And the other thing I think is you raise a really good point in terms of sort of like, you know, portfolio construction. If you buy it, look, you know, you buy it 23p and it goes to £4, then if you're not careful, it becomes a disproportionate sort of size in your portfolio, unless it continues to come up. But as these two unfortunately have come down, then you get that negative impact on your portfolio. So you need to sort of like take profits at some point, just to sort of right size those positions, I guess.
Yes, I think you're right, Paul.
Yeah. Now, another one that I know Richard Crowe, aka Cockney Rebel, likes is Card Factory, with it, I think you've sort of like highlighted as well as a sort of interesting play, which does sort of like, you know, greeting cards and all things gifting.
Yes, well, Richard and I, you know, bounce ideas off each other. We've got completely different approaches. He's absolutely brilliant at identifying turnarounds and overlooked companies, whereas I'm more a numbers man, and I'll flag up the risks and so on. But often taking a risk pays off, and certainly did with Card Factory. It looked very precarious financially, and it even admitted that it was going to have to do a fundraise, but it managed somehow to get through the pandemic without having to dilute. And it's now absolutely transformed. I mean, the recent figures for Card Factory, I think in the Small Cap Value reports, Graham and I turned positive on it, I think early to mid last year. Didn't buy any myself, more's a pity. But yeah, it's always the way, isn't it? But no, I think it looks very good. And I cannot understand why it peaked at £1.10 recently, which looked cheap on the numbers they've just published. And it's drifted down to about 93p. I think possibly it's one of those shares where it's got a lot of private investors who are more like traders, really, you know, who are looking to catch a move up and then just move on. I think possibly that might be the reason, but you never know, do you? Because nobody fills in a form to say why they're selling. Yeah. So we're guessing, but I think it's looking attractive at 93p at the moment. Mm. I just had a look at the broker forecast before we started, and the current consensus seems to be that earnings are actually going to fall in the current year. Not entirely sure why that would be the case. So maybe it's setting itself up to start, you know, beating expectations again.
Yeah.
And your forward P is only 7.5 or 8.
So. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I was going to say myself, it's very, very cheap. And I know I know Richard's committed because he's got 30% of his portfolio in that one.
Yes.
Stock, so.
Yes. And I get the impression, you know, it's a fairly substantial portfolio. So I think he's certainly putting his money where his mouth is.
Yeah.
So, but I think he's got it right. I have to say.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Yeah. Yeah. What about just moving on to Gear for Music, which again is another online brand for musical or retailer for musical instruments. And
it was
a bit of a darling, obviously, during the pandemic, as everybody sort of took up reading and playing music and stuff like that. So, but it's obviously unwound a bit since then.
Yeah, it's got the most hilarious chart. I mean, it literally does a huge surge up to about £10,
Yeah.
then back down to a pound, then another surge up to about £8 or £9, then back
Yeah.
down to a pound. It's
Yeah.
bizarre. But the issue there, obviously, the whole e-commerce sector, as we know, went crazy in the pandemic and then has got totally beaten up since. We talked about that a fair bit before. But the thing so I've only recently gone back into gear for music, and at 79p, actually, I was quite lucky. I caught
Yeah.
the low, or hopefully what it will be the low. And the reason for that was very simple. It was because the bank debt considerably reduced. It took on, I think, too much bank debt, and it had excessive inventories, which isn't necessarily a problem with a musical instrument retailer and audio products, because of course they don't perish. So you can just gradually wind down your excess inventories. But they actually deliberately bought these excess inventories when the supply chain problems were paramount, which did help them gain market share. And I just think if you look at the numbers on Gear for Music, it's a nice little business. It doesn't really make much profit at the moment, but you know, you could see the numbers starting to improve, and the outlook comments were pretty positive, saying that, look, we think this is the low watermark for profitability. The bank debt's rapidly reducing, so I think risk reward on it is now very much better than it was. So that was the reason I went back in at 79p. Not a huge position, but I think that's a nice little one that I've just tucked away.
Well, it's very niche, isn't it? So, you know, I wouldn't have thought it's got masses and masses of competition, because, you know, you'd think the customer retention rates would be a bit higher as well, because if they've gone once there, they may go again, you know.
Well, actually, that's not the case with that. The customers are not, there's not really brand loyalty. But what Gear for Music does is it sets everything up so that it makes a profit on the first transaction.
Right. Okay.
So it, you know, it keeps its marketing customer recruitment costs really low. They make a profit on the first trade, and it doesn't really matter if the customer goes to this big German competitor, Thomann. But it's it's actually a business where, funnily enough, the friction on cross-channel trade due to Brexit might actually have helped Gear for Music, because it means it's more difficult for the Thomann and any other continental competitors to send smallish parcels into Britain. And I'm told that quite a lot of them have just given up and said, it's not worth the hassle, we can't make money from Britain, which then leaves the UK market wide open to Gear for Music. My brother's a musician, he orders a lot of equipment, and he said him and his colleagues have found that it's just so problematic getting deliveries from Germany. They now just buy everything from Gear for Music.
Yeah.
So I thought that was quite interesting.
Oh, it is, yeah, yeah. I mean,
It's set up for quite small, well, not small, but, you know, it's not expensive to set up a distribution centre, just a shed, really, in Europe. So they've got four distribution centres in Europe. They fly or ship the gear direct into those European centres. So they can do the deliveries into Europe from Europe. So they're not getting a corresponding pain the other way. So, and I just think if you look at it, you know, the market cap's absolutely peanuts. And I really like the guy who runs it, Andrew Wass. He's quirky, but you know, very, very, he's one of these people who lives and breathes his business. You know, he founded the thing and still owns a good chunk of it. So I think we should do all right on that one.
Yeah, well, hopefully it'll do sweet music for your portfolio going forward and for others. Now, what about Wix, the DIY or sort of tool? I think, is it Toolstation, is it they do as well? I can't remember, but...
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't hold this one myself.
No, that's Travis Perkinson, that is, I think.
No, Wix is on my, along with Eurocell, which is quite similar in a way, they are on my watch list as things that look fundamentally good value. Obviously struggling a bit this year, but actually trading okay, you know, but because of the slowdown in consumer discretionary spend, they're saying, look, it's not going to be as good as last year. But these just look to me like really fundamentally sound businesses with good balance sheets, well managed, making nice profit margins that you could, as I say, going back to that theme, you look 2-3 years ahead when the economy is hopefully sort of back into normal mode. These shares, I think, Topps Tiles is another one actually like that.
Yeah.
These shares should be usefully higher, I would say. Not the most exciting shares going, you know, you're not going to multi-bag on them, are you? But I just think there's, yeah, quite a good opportunity. I'd like to buy some. I think Eurocell put out a mild profit warning recently, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Have you looked at those ones yourself, Paul?
I haven't looked at it in detail, but I think they do sort of like, you know, recycle PVC windows and doors, don't they? And that's their sort of their niche associated with it. I'd have to look at the balance sheet to really get a firm grasp about whether they're going to have to raise any more money. I'm guessing they don't, but
no, neither. This is what I go. I generally go for things that are really solid, where you don't have to worry about equity dilution, let alone solvency. And that's certainly the case with Eurocell and Wix.
Yeah. So, and with Wix, which is quite interesting, it's trading on about 8x PE. And in the heyday of sort of the 90s, B&Q used to be on high teens, low 20s PE.
Yeah.
And actually, if you compare it to the US with Lowe's and with, there's the really big one, I can't remember what it's called, but they're on high teens as well, sort of like, you know, PE. Mm. So it's a bit of an anomaly, really.
Yeah.
Just because it can't really be Amazoned out, I wouldn't have thought. You know, if you've got sort of like, you know, build DIY building products and stuff like that, it's difficult, isn't it, to deliver in the post?
yeah. And Eurocell have got their own chain of, I think, 200-odd trade counter-type sheds, which are not particularly expensive to run. I think both Wix and Eurocell look good businesses.
Yeah, it was Home Depot is the big one out in the States, which is on about 20 times. Now, just keeping on to the theme of building products, I understand you quite like Forterra and Lords Group, which is a building product sort of like provider, and it does, I think, heating products. And then obviously Forterra is a brick manufacturer or brick maker in the UK, which does London Brick, I think.
I don't know this, but I'm not that well researched on them. But the reason I suggested these as an interesting idea for us to cover is because we've had quite a flurry of trading updates and accounts from the brick and the building materials sector lately. And I just think it's looking quite interesting for people to do more research on, you know, because I only, with the Stockopedia reports I write every day, I only get to give quick reviews on things, really, maybe spending an hour and a half on each company maximum. So we do need to then stress to people, look, you've got to do your own much more detailed work on these things. But what's interesting about the brick companies, I think there's Forterra, there's Michelmersh, there's Brickability, which is...
Yeah, with his distributor. There's Ipstock as well.
Ipstock, yeah. So there's at least, might be another one, but there's at least four. Yeah. And they all seem to be trading well, which I can't understand, because the housing starts, we're told, are down whatever, 25, 30%, something like that. We're told that repair and maintenance work as well is slow, because Marshall's warned on profits about these very same things. And yet these brick companies seem to be sailing through. So, I mean, what's your view? Do you think there's going to be a lag before they warn on profits?
I think you just need to be very careful in terms of what products you're looking at, because the market sort of splits into repair, maintenance and improvements, which is roughly around about 75, 80% of it. And then you've got the new build, which is a sort of like, a, you know, 20, 25% of the market.
Yeah.
Now, with repair and maintenance, it's very, very recurring revenue streams. If things break, you need a new wall or you need a new build, you know, this kind of stuff. The improvement side is where you're getting some sort of like, you know, discretionary element on it. Now, Marshalls, which does sort of pavings out into for landscaping a lot, you know, your patios and stuff like that, that's improvement. It's not repair. You can lift and shift a couple of patios, but it's when it comes to sort of like, you know, mainly, you know, you want something nice in your house, or there's a in a building it wants a new drive or whatever like that. So that's more improvements, whereas your brick boys is more your repair and maintenance on your ongoing, and then your new build.
Interesting.
And then you, which is basically the house builders. What happened after the trust disaster in September, as I understand, most big major house builders just froze breaking ground on new sites.
Yeah.
And this year, they've had, as we all know, they've seen an uptick in, you know, sort of like sales reservations and people interested, certainly over the sort of spring selling season. And now they're just starting to break ground on new sites, not just completing old ones, but on new sites. And that's why the likes of Forterra, Michelmers are saying, yes, the first quarter was slow. Those, you know, effectively deliveries, brick deliveries were less than, you know, we'd anticipate, certainly less than last year. Yeah. But they expect a big tick up next for the second half as these new sites come on and they need bricks, you know. So it's a sort of like it's a two-speed economy. Your paving slabs on Marshalls is your improvement, which is unfortunately, you know, in the eye of the storm.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I did notice that actually that Marshall's shares have pretty much bounced back from this recent mild profit warning, haven't they?
Yeah.
I think the only problem with Marshall's I could see is that they seem to have made a large acquisition at the worst possible time.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with hindsight, I don't think there's any solvency risk with it, but it's certainly got too much debt, I would imagine. Isn't there something as well that's just popped into my head with the brick manufacturers? Isn't there a shortage of UK production?
Yes.
And it's made up with imports?
Yes.
And so when demand drops, it just means that demand for imports drops, but actually, yeah.
Well, what you had at the end of last year, or certainly before the sort of trust economic problem, you had record low inventories across the UK. And that balance was being made up on imports. But clearly this year, the imports have sort of like, you know, have not stopped, but they've reduced significantly because they're more expensive. The imports actually compete more in the sort of the niche areas against the likes of Michelmersh rather than your sort of your Breezebox stuff. I mean, I'm with you. I think it's a really interesting space. And I've just recently bought actually shares in Michelmersh because I think they've got a rock solid balance sheet on a PE of about 9. And, I think I know the management team, they're run by a very good one, very good, you know, sort of like CEO and stuff. The management team for Marshalls is top notch as well. Really industry leading. I've spoken to a lot of people who really rate them.
So. It's interesting, isn't it? No, I think these sectors do look very interesting. I forget which one it was. One of them is just about to commission a brand new factory, aren't they? One of the brick manufacturers.
Fortera, it's in Desford.
Yeah, which it could be quite significant. So, yeah, interesting value sector to look at, I think. I don't hold any myself. But, I just like flagging up interesting ideas.
Yeah. No, you did. Now on the leisure, entertainment and restaurants, you got XP Factory because you were quite bullish on that in February. Do you still hold it? And the sort of
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's my second largest position. And it operates boom battle bars and escape hunt rooms. Forget the historic numbers. They're irrelevant. It did a massive rollout of new sites mid to late last year. So and a lot of the sites are franchised as well, which means that the full revenue numbers don't come through XPF's P&L. So it's the type of share where you have to sort of understand the business model and then look at the note from Shore Capital, which crunches the numbers. And I think it's very, very interesting. It's what I've found is I've mystery shopped the Boom Battle Bar format quite a few times, about probably getting on for 10 times now. And what I've found is just it's experiential leisure where people are playing these games and drinking and having sort of street food type of thing. And the customer experience is so good. Every time I go, there's a brilliant atmosphere and the Oxford Street, London site is rammed.
Yeah.
Any time of the day, any day of the week, absolutely rammed. So I've been there 5 times in the last 2 or 3 months. Same experience every time. Lovely atmosphere. Whole place is buzzing. People, are visibly, nearly every seating space was taken. Nearly every game was being enthusiastically used. You know, I think they're onto an absolute gold mine, definitely from the London site. I don't know about the other sites. Now, we'll find out tomorrow because it's putting out its...
Oh, is it? Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, it's putting out its results tomorrow. So fingers crossed. I really like the management there. Richard Harpin's excellent, I think. Very talented. And we'll see what happens. You do have to be a bit careful with the number of shares in issue. It's got deferred consideration and quite generous share options. And so therefore, I think the current number of shares in issue is 150 million. I'm working on that growing to potentially up to 200 million. So at 20p, that currently the market cap is 40 million, which obviously sounds a lot based on the historic numbers, but the historic numbers are totally out of date now. And I'm hoping it will be profitable by now. But because they opened so many sites at the tail end of last year, you know, that won't have fed through to the 2022 numbers. Yeah. So, I think it's very, very encouraging that. Experiential leisure is a huge growth trend. And this is the only way you can play that, a pure play in terms of a small cap.
Yeah, my colleague actually at Vox Markets has been sort of like singing the tunes of XPF Factory for quite some time.
I know.
He can't get into the Oxford Street store either. So it's absolutely, you're right. I mean, they're sold out, aren't they? It's got to be a statement that the Boom Battle Bars format at least is absolutely flying.
It is, anyway. and the escape rooms apparently just ticks along. Yeah. You know, you do the fixed asset spending, and then it's done. Yeah. You know, and it lasts 5, 6, 7 years. They haven't refreshed any of them, the escape room sites. So, and it's nice the way they're co-locating them. So if you go to the Oxford Street Boom Battle Bar, it's huge. It's subterranean sort of. Industrial style fit out. It's great, I think. Lots of neon lights and really loud banging music, and it's great. But then there's just a door at the end going into the escape room format, so they can get people to book for both, if you like.
Brilliant. What about Host Mall? Because this is one you've you criticised them last time for selling flat coke. it's the TGI Fridays, isn't it? But they've come, the shares have come off a lot. But have now started to pick up just recently.
Yeah, this has been an absolute disaster. I got talked into the whole Electra private equity story, which was a demerger of TGI Fridays, which became called Host Mall, and Unbound Shoes, which was going to pivot to an online. Anyway, both of them have been a total disaster. I'm afraid. So apologies to anyone who followed.
We all have them.
Oh, shockingly bad, shockingly bad. So we really were sold a pup, I think, with both of those. But anyway, that it is what it is. But I always like to look at things fresh if the facts change. And some readers of mine flagged up Host Mall to me because I just abandoned it. I lost my shirt on it. Heavy loss, well into six figures a year or two ago for me personally. But you just put that out of your mind and you look at it fresh, and there are signs of life at Host Mall, I've got to say. And I should disclose, I picked up a tiny, tiny little dip my toe into the water type position personally recently, mainly because I just didn't want to miss out if it multi-bagged.
Have they sorted their coke issue out yet?
I don't know, that's ridiculous. But the CEO was not up to, he was a good talker, but he wasn't a good doer. So they've now got an operations person just hands-on running the business, no new stores, which means it starts to generate cash. And the slide deck they put out recently, Host Mall put out, it's on their website, look very encouraging. They reckon they can pay off all their debt within 2 years. Well, if that happens, your shares are going to be 3, 4, 5 times what they are now. But of course, there's no guarantee. That's an aspiration. Yeah. There's no guarantee that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it is close to being maxed out on the bank borrowings, which they admit they need to refinance later this year. So it is high risk, I've got to say.
Yeah.
You could suddenly get clobbered with a discounted equity raise, you know.
You need broad shoulders for that one.
Now, or just keep the position size small. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. I mean, just on your sort of losses, I mean, I've had the same sort of thing. I mean, you know, I got into Boohoo, lost a big six figure on it. I got into Purple Bricks, and you know that one's been like.
Luckily,
I exited 2 months ago, but even so, that was another big six figure. And then I had a small one, which I had for 3 years, which was Rosslyn Data Tech, and I lost six figures on that one as well.
Bad luck, Paul. We all do it.
I think that's important for investors because, you know, when they hear you and they hear me, et cetera, and they think, you know, everything is going to come good and smell of roses. Well, that reality doesn't happen because I don't know what your hit rate is, but mine's only just over 60%, and I bet yours is probably the same. So you've got to accept.
Well, It depends what period you look at. I would say in the last 2 years, my hit rate's probably been close to zero.
Well, over a longer period, over your 20 years, 30 years, I bet you a normal investor like yourself, not a good investor like yourself, will be 60%. So, but it's still
In normal markets, I normally get more right than wrong.
Yeah.
And what I do find is that the winners, it will tend to be disproportionately large amounts of money.
Yes.
You know, because you concentrate in it and you get a big, you know, if you get a 4 or 5 bagger in a position that's a big part of your portfolio, that mops up all the small mistakes and still leaves you with a, most years I make good money. I'm not going to complain. I've just had a particularly bad run lately, but you know, I'm rebuilding it quite well this year, really. So,
And the other thing, to, you know, as a principle is that, you know, assuming going the other way, you know, if you're wrong, sort of like, you know, 40 to 35% of the time, you don't double down on losers traditionally, because if you're not careful, because you've just got to accept you are wrong at least a third of the time. And if you start,
it's tricky though, isn't it?
You suffer.
Yeah, well, I think it depends if the fundamental investment case is wrong, or whether you just happen to be, say, 50% underwater on the random point where you happen to buy. You know, so some of my best investment gains have come from things where I've just averaged down and averaged down and averaged down because I knew I was right.
Okay.
But the trouble is, sometimes you get it wrong, don't you? And as you say, averaging down just for the sake of it is a disastrous strategy. But actually taking a step back, forgetting that you own it at all, and looking at it fresh and thinking, I'm definitely right on this. You know, sometimes averaging down can be brilliant, can work really, really. I remember Trinity Mirror, when that just went down and down and down and down, eventually got to 25p when it was on a PE of just over 1. And I looked at it, I thought, I'm not wrong on this. My figures are just, this was years ago.
No, I remember it was about 2010, wasn't it? Because I remember you and I were working together at, you know, in a research house, and you spotted it. In fact, you were the only one in the world who had spotted it. And you did really, really well.
Yeah, I was a few months early. But yeah, it went, I think it 10-bagged, didn't it?
From that low.
So it just shows, I don't think there's any general rule, but certainly if it's a speculative company where it's running out of cash, you know, it's just a story stock, you know, and you're 40 or 50% down, then throwing more money at it is usually the wrong move, isn't it?
Well, I'm glad I didn't do that with either Boohoo or with Purple Bricks.
Because
that would have cost me a fortune. Now, another one which sort of like we've talked about a few times is Revolution Bars, which is another market sort of premium sort of, you know, bar and restaurants and stuff like that. What's your latest on that one? Because it's got a great format. It just seems to issue a lot of equity all the time.
Yeah, I mean, this I treat as a special situation. I don't particularly like the business, but I just thought at 6p it was oversold.
Yeah,
there are 230 million shares in issue, so it's a lot of business for the money. And with 75% gross margin, 75-80%, I think the hospitality sector generally is really highly leveraged to an improvement in consumer sentiment, which I think could be happening. So I'd be happy to get, if they got to 20p, I'd sell them, you know. So it's not a big conviction thing, Revolution Bars. I just think it's too cheap.
Yeah. What about Warpaint, the cosmetics, sort of like challenger brand? Because that's a really high class outfit that seems to be growing incredibly fast.
I absolutely love it. I mean, the investment case there couldn't be simpler. It's just that they're winning more orders from bigger retailers all around the world. They do trial orders with a big retailer, and then, you know, they put it into maybe 20 shops. Next thing they'll come back and they'll want to put it in 200 shops. So it couldn't be simpler. The product, the customers like the product, and the retailers buy more of it. That's it.
Yeah, it seems to be sort of like if you've got the right sort of brand or the right imagery associated with it, then you're doing really well in that whole area as people go out and socialize. But then you've got other brands which obviously have fallen on hard waters in this cosmetics, which has really sort of struggled. So yeah, I mean, they've got that sort of magic sort of formula, haven't they?
Yeah, I interviewed the CEO, Sam Bazzini. I used to do these CEO interviews for fun, really. They're not commercial. And I just wanted to get to the bottom of the business model and why, you know, they keep putting these outperform statements. And it was really good. It was a few months ago now. And he just explained, you know, the product, the customers like the product and the retailers will order more of it.
Yeah, good.
So I love the business model. The only thing I would say is the shares have had a very good run, probably up with events now. Again, I don't hold any personally, but I've been writing very, very enthusiastically about Warpaint on Stockopedia now for at least a year, probably longer. And I think quite a few of the readers bought some after my interview, actually. Yeah. So hopefully that'll help them make back some of the losses we all suffer from Boohoo. I feel terrible when you talk enthusiastically about a stock and people follow you in and it's a disaster. It's just a gut-wrenching feeling because, you know, we want to help people make money as well as make money ourselves, don't we? So
no, you're right. Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. You know, if you hold yourself out there and you're sort of like giving, you know, sort of like, you know, ideas and all this sort of stuff, it's just inevitable that you're going to be, as we talked about, you know, you can't have a perfect 100% hit rate. Nobody does.
No.
You know, everybody makes mistakes.
Some of the readers do expect that.
I keep
emphasizing I'm not clairvoyant. You know, I do not know what the future holds. And literally the facts start to change the next day after you've written something about a company, it's already out of date. And don't you think business models seem to change so much faster now?
Yes.
With the internet and all the rest of it, you know, something that's top dog now could be displaced by some Chinese competitor, as we saw with Shein. You know, quite quickly things change, don't they?
I think actually it will get even faster because with regenerative AI, coming forward.
Oh, yes.
I think that will really, it'll extenuate those, you know, who the winners and the losers. And there'll be a lot of losers who you frankly think, crikey, you know, they're going to be in impregnable positions, but it's going to remove that sort of economic moat from their businesses. Mm. And that'll start to unravel quite quickly. So yeah, yes. I'm with you. You've got to be very, very careful that you can, you know, justify a share that either doesn't get impacted by regenerative AI or is actually, you know, going to be a net beneficiary from it. And it's very difficult at this early stage to really sort of comprehend that. But I can see some bombs exploding in the next 12 months if you're in the wrong places.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating topic, isn't it? Whenever I have lunches or phone calls and Zooms with investors, artificial intelligence is the topic everyone wants to learn about, talk about, and so on. I mean, I don't pretend to understand it. And I don't really understand how this, I know this linguistic model of breaking words up into parcels and putting numbers on them and predicting what next follows that and so on. I kind of vaguely get that, but I don't understand at all how that translates into actual, the computer understanding things or... Mm. Do you know what I mean?
What I would say, the best thing for investors, and you might want to do it as well, is go on to ChatGPT, create yourself an account and start using it. I use it a lot. It's absolutely brilliant for research. Like, for instance, if you wanted to do sort of like, you know, look into medical testing and diagnostics, some nearly niche area, it's absolutely fabulous. You've just got to ask the right questions. So, for instance, the ones I ask are, you know, I'll ask ChatGPT, pretend to be Paul Scott going through the balance sheet of this medical diagnostics. Tell me what you think. And it comes out with, now, Paul will say this, bang, bang. But I mean, I don't put your name in clearly, but just pretend to be an expert in medical diagnostics. It's absolutely fabulous. Areas that you're not familiar with or for instance, I mean, another one I've done is, you know, pretend to, you know, what will be the impact of regenerative AI on the online portal industry? Things like, you know, moneysupermarket.com and all the other sites. I mean, it's fascinating what it says, and it gives you a really good balanced view that, yes, that may not be sort of like absolutely crystal, you know, 100% correct because nobody can predict the future, but it gives you some good pointers about the variables. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I've played around with it quite a bit, but I don't think I've got the hang of asking it the right questions. So it would be good to see some sort of maybe online tutorial, if anything exists, where it can explain to ordinary people like me how we actually use it, because I haven't quite grasped that yet. And some of my friends, quite a lot of my investor friends have tried ChatGPT, And what the general consensus seems to be, and most of these guys are pretty tech savvy in my investor group, where I have a sort of private chat room with them, they say it's like having an incredibly enthusiastic and hardworking and unbelievably fast research assistant who's desperate to please you. And will sometimes, take shortcuts and actually make things up. So you've got to really check their work carefully. But so, I mean, RWS is an interesting one, isn't it? This is the patent translation firm.
Yeah.
Quite big market cap, mid cap, really. Mm. And that's just drifting down and down and down. And it's now a value share, I think, PE of 9.5 or something. And I did wonder, maybe, you know, that could be a type of business where suddenly 85% of the work could be done by AI. Mm.
Another one to watch is Learning Technology Group, which was a £1 million business, but it one of its sort of like I mean, it's different, but
a billion
plus market cap. But you had news from Chegg, which was an online student, information service, and that their shares halved when they said they're being cannibalized by ChatGPT. But things like corporate learning, things like, you know, education, ed tech, I mean, that's just going to be, you know, really, really disrupted.
And
the difficulty is to stay ahead of that disruption, but it'll be quite difficult. So I, you know, as I say, Learning Technology Group would be something I'd highlight that could well be impacted big time.
Yeah, and lawyers and accountants and all that sort of thing, I guess. I know some of my law. I've got a circle of sort of legal friends up in London, and they're all having kittens about AI. You know, I mean, I had to pay a solicitor once, I think, £1,500 to compare two leases for the flat I lived in, you know, but I didn't ask him to do it. He just took it upon himself to do it, then billed me £1,500.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's something that surely AI could just do in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the searches and stuff like that. So you're exactly right. It's one to watch. There's no doubt about it.
Definitely. I'd love to know more about it. So, yeah.
Well, one on the software front you like and you may own is Eagle Eye, which is basically it does online sort of discounts and promotions for lots of big sort of retailers and brands and stuff like that. And it must be, as the cost of living crisis, it must be doing well, or a thought.
Yes. I mean, this has been listed for years and it was always one of these jam tomorrow things, growing, but quite painfully slowly.
Yeah.
But I can't get my head around the valuation. It looks a very expensive share, but I think occasionally you spot something that's got such impressive referent clients who are completely embedded in this business. You know, they buy, it does the loyalty schemes for supermarkets.
Yeah.
But the one that Asda's just launched is through Eagle Eye. I just think it looks such an impressive business. And it's global as well. Mm. It's doing contracts with, I like any business that can flag up a long list of really serious major international clients and not, you know, just buying something trivial from them, but actually buying something quite business critical from them. You think, hang on, something's going on here. So I think I'd be interested in what your listeners think about Eagle Eye. I've taken a small standard size position in it just to start off with, and they've made a recent acquisition of something in France, Untie Knots, I think it's called. Yeah. And there was some, I just think it looks a really interesting business, but I haven't got a clue how to value it, which is not the type of thing I would normally go for. I normally do like to have a cheap valuation as well. But when you find something that really does look unique, I think you've got to push the boat out a bit, haven't you?
Well, all I would say is that Judith McKenzie likes it, and she's a real sort of value investor. So she sees the upside.
But did you interview her recently? That rings
I did. Yeah, she talked about it. Yeah, she liked. She did say it's probably up with events at the moment.
Yes,
but my view is sort of like that one and Warpaint, which is the other one you highlighted, which are top class international business. If they ever get sold off as a baby in the bathwater indiscriminately in a market, then those are the kind of really high class, top quality companies with great margins, really strong brands you want to put in your portfolio for the long term.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, those, certainly Eagle Eye and Sassandar, you know, I've bought those really with a 5-year. outlook. I'm not going to trade them or even really look at the share price. I just want to tuck those away. No gearing. I've just bought them outright in my SIP and I'll just see what happens. And you know, you could easily have a 5-bagger or more with those in the long run.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. Now, just moving on to sort of industrials, Reynolds, which I think is the chain manufacturer and
yes,
sort of conveyor belts and stuff like that in sort of the mining and industrial activities. I think it had a big pension problem, I think, at one stage, but that must be recovering, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's done very well. It's got a great brand name. Apparently, it's the leader in industrial chains. It's a very good business, you know, but it's the market hasn't latched onto this yet, and I think is still pricing it like it's a turnaround or even a basket case. But actually, look at the latest numbers. It's really comprehensively turned around now. Mm. They're on the front foot making acquisitions. I rate the guy running it, and he's put in a fair bit of his own money buying shares in the market as well. He's really worked hard on this turnaround over years. And so the idea is the more acquisitions they do, and they're not straining their balance sheet doing these acquisitions, they're using a bit of debt, but the banks have just increased their, I think a fourth bank joined their existing three banking syndicate, which has given them an uplift from, I think this is off the top of my head, 63 million to about 85 million total bank facilities. They're not using a lot of that. And it turned out during the pandemic and all this inflationary period, they've demonstrated now in the last 3 or 4 years that they've got really good pricing power. So they can pass on their raw materials and their energy costs. They've demonstrated that, they've done it. And they've also got recurring demand, because a lot of the chains that they manufacture have a kind of preset lifespan.
Yeah.
And if you've got, I don't know, say baggage handling carousel at an airport, or dozens of them more like, all driven by chains made by Reynolds or whoever else, you know, the last thing you want is those chains actually failing and it brings your airport to a standstill. Yeah. And it's often, the CEO told me that the chains are often only about 1% of the total cost of the machinery. So you just replace, you know, they're built to last 6 years, you replace them every 5 years. Mm. And regular as clockwork, irrespective of the economic backdrop. So these are features I really, really like about Reynolds. And it hasn't had to dilute shareholders. Yeah. It's managed to bring its gearing down, and it's managed to get through the pandemic and the energy crisis and the inflation all without dilution. And it's chucking, I think, 5 million a year into its pension scheme. So over time, that should gradually reduce as well. Yeah. And with acquisitions, they buy businesses that don't have pension deficits. So it sort of dilutes the pension issue into a much bigger business. So again, I don't think it'll shoot the lights out, but I wouldn't be surprised. To me, I think Reynolds is worth about double the current price, which is 27-28p. I'd be disappointed if I'm selling that below 50p.
No, I'm with you. I think anything like that is an industrial application which is mission critical, and the cost of failure by the client of a part like that is so huge, not only in monetary terms but in sort of reputational terms. It just means that they're going to keep on going back to the number one brand, Reynolds.
So, yeah,
and yeah, I'm with
the,
you.
The CEO said, you know, the customers will pay five times the price that they can get an equivalent product from China from.
Yes, exactly.
They don't want it to break, so they pay us five times what the competitors are doing, you know.
Yeah. What about Watkin Jones, which is basically a student property builder and a buy-to-let, and I think it seems to have a reasonably pretty good strong balance sheet, trading on about 7x PE. Again, very cheap.
It's very cheap, Watkin Jones is. I should add, I think I forgot to say, I do hold a small position in Reynolds and a position in Watkin Jones as well. Now, Watkin Jones, now the interesting thing on this is obviously they've had a bit of a hiatus with their project. So they build, you know, things like a student hall of residence, but they forward sell it to a pension fund or whatever before they've even started building it. So there's no actual sort of building risk as such, or very little. And they get these things right. They've got a very good track record and they third party out the actual construction anyway.
Yeah.
But what I think the interesting angle on Watkin Jones, aside from the fact that it's cheap and it's a recovery play, I think H1 results will be poor, because they've already told us they will, and because there was a sort of gap in the projects caused by the mini budget. But that's fine. That's just a temporary factor. But the interesting thing is they reckon the next budget will loosen the rules on pension funds, pension schemes, because the government wants them to invest in infrastructure. Well, it strikes me that Watkin Jones could well be a big beneficiary of that, you know, because they also want to do build to rent, not just student stuff. So I think it could be one to watch, I think, maybe for a recovery. Again, I'm thinking 2-3 years out on that one.
And they've got a very good track record, and for the shares to be... what are they? Less, well, just under a pound. I mean, it looks cheap value to me.
It's very cheap. And as you say, really nice, strong balance sheet. Yeah. So no solvency risk. Yeah, I like Watkin Jones. Just it's a tuck away and forget type of thing that we could do all right on, I think. I hope.
What about Kitwave, which is the distributor of sort of like, you know, products into convenience stores around the UK? I think it competes with the likes of Booker's. I know Richard Crowe again likes this one.
Yes, well, he pointed me in the direction of this and says, you know, have a look at the numbers, Scotty, and give them the once over. So KITW is the ticker for Kitwave.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've written about it very positively on Stockopedia, where every time I've looked at the trading updates and the results, I think it looks good value. Richard identified that the, I think it's the founder, isn't it, who's the CEO still, who's been running it for decades, really seems to know what he's doing, self-funding its expansion, so there's no worry about dilution, and in a very fragmented space where they can just mop up small businesses where perhaps, or small wholesalers where perhaps the owner wants to retire or something along those lines. And actually, Lord's Trading, I think, has quite a few different sector, but has a quite a few similarities, I think. That's building products again, isn't it?
It's building products. I mean, obviously, Kitwave is more to do with everyday sort of like, you know, ice creams all that kind of goes into the convenience store. So it's sort of like stronger, probably recurring revenue streams, I guess.
Yes, good point. Yeah. Lord's, the only drawback I found on it was that the shareholding structure is too concentrated. I think the founder owns, a much too high percentage. I think AIM needs to change the rules and stop allowing companies to float where, you know, I mean, we've come across some examples recently. Delisting risk. You mentioned iEnergizer, didn't you? I mean, the founder, I think, held 83%.
Yeah.
Well, of course, they can then pass a special resolution, which takes away everyone's rights over everything.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. And then I found another one, Mirada, a real nanocap, which it announced it's going to delist, where I think one guy owns 87%.
Right.
And you think, I mean, AIM should not be allowing anything to float with that shareholding structure. It's absurd.
Well, particularly with iEnergizer, I mean, I think the market cap at that time was about £500 million, wasn't it? So
I know, that was real.
Must have caught a lot of people off guard.
Yeah, definitely. And the numbers look great. I mean, I looked at it a few times. And, you know, it seemed to be a cash machine. It had been listed a long time as well. It wasn't a fly-by-night thing. I think it had been listed 14 years. And then just suddenly, the controlling shareholder just suddenly said, nah, I'm going to delist. This is a waste of time.
You got that at the great financial crisis, didn't we, as well? We had quite a few of them delisting.
But
it's part and parcel of what it is, I guess. That's why... You know, the government gives tax incentives for people to be on AIM because it's it can be a bit of a wild west at times.
It can. And I mean, I think we need a big clear out. We just need to my view, AIM shouldn't be whatever it is now. It was at one point, it was well over 1,000 companies, wasn't it, on AIM? I think, is it down to 800-ish or something like that now?
Yeah, there aren't 800 investable entities there, that's for sure.
True. Yeah, it's probably 200 or 300 tops, I would consider investable.
What about another one which might be delisting fairly soon, we don't know, is WAN Disco, because obviously you talked about that 3 months ago, and then it had a real sort of like shocking revelation, didn't it, of really sort of like sales order fraud, I think, out in the States.
Oh, it was a catastrophe. No, I mean, talk about egg on my face, I'm just, you know, basically a walking omelet. It's just a complete disaster. But, you know, I just believe the trading updates. It never occurred to me. I mean, you could see that the CEO was extremely promotional and but, you know, over a series of about 9 months, WAN Disco put out all these series of trading updates confirming specific orders with a client in whichever sector, all look completely kosher. Turns out they suddenly announced one day earlier this year, the whole thing was fraudulent. that 200 million of bookings, sales bookings, were made up. And we're told it was by one individual, one salesman. Pull the other one. I don't know anybody who believes that. Yeah. But anyway, moving on from the fact that it's been a complete catastrophe, shares are still suspended. It is coming back from suspension.
Is it? They've got a date.
Yeah, it's coming back. They've announced they're going to raise $30 million. And I've heard, that's quite recently in the last few days. I've heard from a chum in the city that, they're going to get the fundraiser away. The only question is at what price. Mm. Obviously, it won't be anything, I'd be surprised if it's even 10% of the suspension price. But the other point I wanted to mention is that the smartest investors you can think of often get taken in by these things. And so I looked at WANdisco and thought, well, Richard Griffith, who I think, it slipped my mind, but he's worth a huge amount, isn't he? Did he set up Evolution or one of those big fund manager companies?
No, you're right. Even the smartest brains, you got Richard Penny from Crooks, and I believe Christopher Mills as well out of a small position.
Did he? Gosh.
Albeit he did say to me when he went, I think he got it about 18 months ago. He did say to me, treat this as highly speculative because of their track record. So I don't think it was a monster position for him.
Well, Richard Griffith had 60 million quids worth of shares in it. I Googled it before we started today, and it says, I think, joint top position. So somebody with that investment caliber who got taken in by it, as well, it does make you think, doesn't it? That really.
It does, yeah. I mean, you're wrong. People are wrong, aren't they? That's the point, is that you get this sort of like, and, the proverbial does hit the fan occasionally, whereby, and that comes down to sort of like, portfolio construction, right-sizing positions. I mean, I've got a large position in one stock myself, and I've got this situation where I really like it, and it's got significant upside, but at some point I'm just going to have to right-size it, top slice, get some, take some profits off the table, even though I don't want to. It just becomes... If you can't sleep at night, then that's not the point of stock picking, is it?
No, but it's a lovely problem to have, though.
It's high class, until it turns the other way.
When I looked at my watch list today, I thought, oh, Paul will be in high spirits today when I saw the Equals. The stock you're referring to, EQLS, has put on a very impressive spurt above a pound today. So it's good to see that working out.
I haven't sold any at all yet. So, we'll wait and see. What's your sort of top three positions then? So you mentioned you got the second one was, what was it again? It was XP Factory, wasn't it? Your second largest. What would you want in number three? Your first
I bought all of these in January with my Seraphine proceeds, and they're all up about 25%. So I'm really, really pleased. In a pretty lousy market. So the top one is BOTB, the on supercar competition.
Oh, okay, yeah, best of the best.
Yeah, we did mention this one last time, yes. I think. I'm just sitting tight on that. I think it's very cheap, PE about 9. It's just a cash machine, very well run. Plus, you've got the speculative upside of Teddy Sagi owning 30%.
Oh, yes.
And wanting to share his expertise on online marketing, which we... I remember you said, he knows a lot about that last time. And he might bid for it, although I hope he doesn't in a way. And basically, it's now an international expansion story. So you can imagine how that could re-rate if you take 20 years of successfully, profitably, cash generatively running these competitions in the UK. Mm. They suddenly announce, right, we're going to do them in Germany, America, Australia. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You could really multi-bag on that if the international expansion takes off. And it's cheap as it is today. So, I really like BOTB.
That's your biggest position, is it?
Biggest position, I mean, my positions are not anywhere near as big as these.
What's your third one? So you've got XP Factory.
XP Factory is the second one. Yeah. So tomorrow I'll either look like a complete Wally or I'll look like a genius. So we'll see. The third one, what's the third one? Oh, I think it might actually be Revolution Bars. It shouldn't be. That's too risky. Yeah. But, and then other things I like, we've covered Eagle Eye, haven't we? And Renault. I think we've covered most of my main positions. Yeah.
Okay, well, look forward in touching base and in the Mellow event in the next couple of days. I'm down
yes,
on Wednesday.
I hope to see you, Paul, and and the listeners and viewers of your channel, hopefully.
Yeah, well, thanks very much again for all the insights, Paul. Fantastic to go through all of them. And as I say, very best of luck and with all those investments. And a big thanks for all the investors, you know, listen to this, because they really do get a lot of benefit from what you say and you write, particularly.
Well, it's all about swapping ideas, isn't it? It's a team sport, as I always say, stock.
Yes,
picking.
Exactly. Thanks very much then, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.